Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 8th of February, as we record. To start today, we are going to talk about the big deal of the week. That's Barratt Developments' $2.5 billion all-share takeover offer for smaller rival Redrow. We'll ask if the deal makes sense, if it's a sign of more things to come for house builders, and if it's a sign of better things to come for the housing market. Then we are going to look at the problems at Carex maker PZ Cousins, which was forced into a dividend cut this week due to circumstances beyond its control, specifically the major devaluation in the Nigerian naira. We will ask if there's any light at the end of that particular tunnel. By contrast, buybacks could soon be on the agenda again at British American Tobacco, which reported full-year results this morning. But of course, the company has plenty of structural and regulatory headwinds to contend with. We'll discuss its prospects later on as well. And to finish, we will wrap things up with a look at Virgin Money's latest trading update and ask what it tells us both about the bank and maybe the state of the economy in general. Joining me to discuss all of this are Julian Hoffman.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Julian. And in the studio, Mark Robinson.
How's it going, Dan?
Very good, thank you. Mitchell Abiak, hi Mitch.
Hi Dan.
And Chris Akers down from Scotland. Hi Chris.
Hi Dan.
Welcome everyone. I almost forgot to introduce you all, but I've done it now. So let's move on to the first company of the day. And as mentioned, well, it's more like two companies because there is this takeover deal, Mitch, Barratt Developments and Redrow. Barratt was already the UK's largest house builder. This will make it even bigger. What's the thinking behind the deal?
Yeah, I think the thinking behind the deal is that Redrow is cheap. I mean, a lot of house builders are quite cheap at the moment, both on a sort of discount to net assets and price earnings ratio. And Barratt has a fair bit of net cash, so it's looking to grow. Also, the market is you know, kind of choppy at the moment. Anyone who's tried to buy a house or has noticed their own value of their own home going down or the increase in interest rates will know why the market's not doing so well. But it's you can imagine Barratt is buying Redrow to sort of bolster itself as the downturn continues, and then maybe hopefully sort of take advantage of a market upturn by being a larger company. So yeah, I think that's the rationale behind the deal. But there's a lot of howevers to that rationale. But that's the sort of basic thinking at the moment.
And is it a sensible move? I mean, Redrow shares were up a decent amount on Wednesday when the deal was announced, or Tuesday, I can't remember now. Barratt's, though, were down a few percent, so market seemed a little underwhelmed. Some analysts, some observers are a bit more positive. What's your sense on whether this makes sense from Barratt's point of view?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the share prices move often in reaction to people trying to take arbitrage from what the enlarged company will look like. But in terms of whether it's sensible for all the reasons you've mentioned, I mean, there's an argument that it's not because, I mean, IC writer Robin Hardy has pointed out you don't get much in the way of economies of scale in house building. So if you're sort of, if you look at the sort of the margins of all the listed house builders, even from the tiny MJ Gleeson and Springfield all the way up to the giants that you pointed out, Barratt and Taylor Wimpey, their margins are quite similar. So there's no guarantee that by becoming even bigger, you know, it will sort of make all these synergies that it says is sort of motivated the deal. Also, there's questions around how they'll achieve those synergies. The implication seems to be that they're going to sack a lot of people to achieve those, you know, efficiencies, which sort of undermines buying the Redrow brand in the first place, because of course that attention to detail and quality is what they're sort of famous for. So yeah, and then I suppose the other sort of question about whether it's sensible is the branding. I mean, this you can look at this two ways. You can look at this as a positive for the deal and a negative for the deal, in that Barratt has a very different sort of model to Redrow. Redrow develops these very expensive homes, and Barratt develops sort of more mass market homes. And it's sort of how those two strategies will fit together. Obviously, they're going to keep the brand separate, and they're going to keep Chief Executive Matthew Pratt in charge. But, you know, there's a question about how those sort of two different cultures might fit together. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, as you say, there is that spread across the market, perhaps, that the deal might offer, from the higher end Red Road to the mid and lower end that the Barratt offers. Also, maybe the potential that they can do more geographically, because, as you said, this is an all-share deal, but Barratt is relatively cash-rich. Red Row has some more balance sheet constraints. Therefore, the combined company should be able to free up some of those constraints from the Red Row side of things and expand more in areas where Red Row hasn't been able to, but might have done if it had a bit more flexibility with its own balance sheet. I wanted to talk, though, about the prospects of this deal going through as is as well, because some speculation in some quarters that maybe there could be a sweetener to the deal, maybe someone else could come in. Equally, it does have to clear the competition authorities as well.
Yeah, those are two very valid points. I mean, on the sort of whether we might see a bigger offer come in, or even another buyer, it is a good question. RBC Capital Markets seems to think that the deal is at sort of the lower end of when you look at sort of previous house builder deals, they've come in at a much higher premium than 25% premium to net asset value, which is sort of what this deal comes in at. So they might go back and come in with a bigger offer, because Red Row shareholders could turn it down. Although, Red Row's 15% of Red Row shareholders, a large part of that being Steve Morgan, do agree with the deal. So there's that to bear in mind. If we are, speculating about another potential offer, my money would be on Taylor Wimpey. Now, this is pure speculation, but we rate Taylor Wimpey as a better company than Barratt. Just in-house, our rating for Taylor Wimpey is buy, whereas Barratt's is hold. And admittedly, it hasn't posted its full-year results yet, but in its trading update for the last calendar year, it said it managed to raise prices while cutting production. Meanwhile, Barratt and its results dropped prices and cut production. And it expects, and this is Taylor Wimpey, expects profit to come in at the top end of consensus, which would still be a big drop, but it's good in the circumstances. And it too has a decent balance sheet. It's of a similar size. The rationale would be the same. So if we are going to see another offer, maybe at a higher premium, I think Taylor Wimpey is the company to do that. So, and then I suppose there's also a question about whether Barclay might make a move, because it too is a luxury house builder. So you can see sort of more of a sort of cultural fit there. But I mean, this of course is speculation. There might not be any other buyers in the market. Private equity is obviously a question as well. But and then in terms of the competition side of it, it's something that perhaps deserves more discussion, because the CMA is due to produce a report at the end of this month detailing its view about the house builders. Readers may remember that a while ago the CMA said it was investigating whether or not house builders control pricing using their land banks. They also were investigating a sort of connected competition issue regarding estate management charges, which we've written about in some detail in the magazine. Now, the house builders, obviously worth pointing out, the house builders deny that they're controlling pricing via land banks and deny that they're sort of gaming the estate management charges system. But the CMA has pointed to evidence to suggest that they do control the market. So there is a big question about whether it looked kindly on the creation of an even larger house builder with a 91,000 home land bank, considering it's currently investigating whether land banks equate to market control. Yeah, there's a lot of it's not a done deal just yet, despite the sort of confidence in the RNS.
Yeah, the land bank point is interesting as well. I mean, there are some who think Barratt does need more land itself, and Red Row has that particular attraction of a good quality land bank, so that's why it's buying them, which might, the CMA might look at that, as you say. Equally, the companies, I think, say, we'll be able to build more housing together than we would separately, which, the proof will be in the pudding, but obviously that's their kind of counter argument to that. So we'll see how that sticks. What about the results themselves? You mentioned Barratt there. What about Red Row? What kind of condition is it in as a company that's potentially about to be acquired now?
Yeah, so on the one hand, the results are very similar, because they both of them, as you'd expect, sales and profit are way down because the housing market is in a slump. But there are some differences. Barratt is in has a better net cash position, but its forward sales are down, which is not ideal. Whereas with Red Row, it doesn't have as much net cash, because obviously it's spent that investing into the business. But forward sales have ticked up ever so slightly. So it then begins to sort of explain the rationale behind the deal, because Barratt has cash to spend, so it's decided to spend a house builder which has better forward prospects. Redrow has less cash, so it's accepted a cash injection into its business at a premium from a bigger player. It's obviously difficult to sort of look at the two results separately without imagining the deal. But I would say that the deal is, if you're a Redrow shareholder, I'd say it's a slightly better deal than if you're a Barratt shareholder. There's the question about whether they should agree to the deal, but you know, they've booked that sort of, they've got this sort of premium almost locked in, as it were. It's whether someone comes in and makes a better offer. There is a sort of, you know, take profits and sell argument for Redrow shareholders at the moment, because the deal is at that premium and the future fortunes of the market are hard to judge. Notably, Investec downgraded Redrow from a buy to a hold for precisely that reason. So they said, you know, the announcement means the shares are now at fair value, which is sort of a solid argument for Redrow shareholders looking at those results, looking at the offer and saying, you know, perhaps take this win, as it were, and reinvest somewhere else.
Mm. The other question is, will we see more of this kind of activity? And also, what does this mean for the housing market, if it means anything there? RBC, again, we've mentioned a couple of times, had an interesting point about Steve Morgan, the Redrow founder, who also has a strategic land business, and they think maybe he's trying to crystallize some shares to call the bottom of the market and so he can use some money to buy up more land, which, you know, would be an incredibly convoluted way to try and call what is a very hard thing to call anyway. But could this deal be the sign of things to come in terms of more deals, but also, you know, housing market, as we've seen, is not doing as badly as some people thought. You know, mortgage rates are starting to come down, will presumably continue to come down if interest rates start to fall later this year, as people assume. You know, what do we think on that regard?
Yeah, whether it means more M&A activity is an interesting question. I suppose that the answer to that is that it depends partly on the CMA, which we've already discussed. Whether sort of, you know, private equity or sort of other house builders might see opportunity in economies of scale. There's a lot of reasons for that, but also there's a lot of reasons, as we've discussed, why economies of scale don't quite work for house builders. Having said that, Vistry, at least so far, has managed to make it work. In-house, we rate that company as a buy because it seems to have made it work. Admittedly, it is doing something quite different because it's moved entirely into bulk sales. So maybe there's an argument to be made that you can scale up that, but it's harder to scale up private sales. As for sort of whether at the bottom of the market, it's a very tough one, isn't it? I mean, there's, you know, we're looking at sort of RICS data suggesting that state agents are much more confident than they have been. It's the first time in a long time, actually, there's been a net positive sort of reaction to the RICS survey. And of course, house prices, according to Halifax, have gone up for the fourth consecutive month. So it looks like the housing market is recovering. But that can take a while to feed through to the results of the house builders themselves. So yeah, certainly house builders are cheap at the moment. So there's an argument to be made that, you know, we might see more activity, but yeah, lots of questions, more questions than answers.
As ever. Yeah, as you say, Vistry, there was that deal for Countryside just over a year ago as well. So there has been some other activity. Before we move on, Julian, do you have thoughts on this deal, the attractiveness or otherwise of it?
Well, my main thought is whether they're going to call it RORAT or Red Row or something. I don't know. It's going to have to change the name in an innovative way.
I think they are going for a Barratt Red Row, but you're right. Maybe they could go with something more.
Yeah, Red Rat. Red Rat would be my personal favourite.
Yeah.
It's an interesting deal, I think, from the point of view of how investors are going to look at it. As you know, Mitch is obviously Mitch is the expert in this field, but the valuation is quite attractive for the sector as a whole, and you do wonder whether the discount premium is now big enough that investors can start punting a bit on this. But I would say that from a value point of view, that's there is something interesting there. But the dynamics of the market are are just tied up with interest rates and really beyond the control of these individual companies, I think. And like everything else, it's a leverage play on that.
Indeed. I know you mentioned Robin Hardy earlier, Mitch, and he has written about why this recovery may be slower, more gradual than some other ones. But nonetheless, as you say, Julian, if we see interest rate expectations come down, you can be assured of a pretty decent rally for the sector. So swings and roundabouts, but we'll keep an eye on this deal and see if any more emerge, as I'm sure our listeners will too. For now, though, we are going to move on to PZ Cousins to start with, Chris, the Carex maker, as I said at the top. They had a pretty bad week, it's fair to say, reporting interim results, but the big thing was the dividend cut due to the devaluation of the Naira. Can you say a bit more about that, first of all, and about how that's affected them?
Yeah, so a very weak set of results from PZ Cousins. For context, Nigeria is the company's biggest single market, which is something a lot of investors might not be aware of. The value of the Naira has plunged since the Nigerian central bank floated the currency last summer. It's down 70% over the past year and fell 40% in the week before the company's results. So obviously it's going to have a significant impact on the financials. Management said it was prudent to cut the dividend by almost a half because of the material impact on the results of the devaluation. This meant a painful, almost £90 million foreign exchange loss in the half. Africa revenue fell by a third, and the company also cut its forecast for operating profits for the full year.
Yeah, I mean, the question with the Nigerian business, I suppose, is what do they do? Again, this is, you know, somewhat, well, entirely out of their hands, certainly the valuation of the currency. But they've been trying some things in recent months, haven't they, to try and improve at least the perception of the business and their handling of it. They've been trying to repatriate cash effectively from the business quickly. They've also, you know, buying out minority shareholders, I think. Is that right? Nonetheless, when you're faced with a currency which is collapsing, there's only so much you can do to protect revenues and profits.
Yeah, so as you say, you're trying to do a couple of things, including repatriating cash. They actually raised prices they went through 12 rounds of price hikes in the half in Nigeria to try and address the very volatile situation, but that obviously wasn't enough to protect or grow revenues. As you say, as they announced last year, they're trying to delist the Nigerian subsidiary through buying out minority shareholders. This is expected to complete by the end of this financial year, but I think the latest evaluation news means management's hands are very tied. It's very limited in what they can actually do to turn things around in Nigeria.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, the reason Nigeria is doing this is to, free float of the currencies, to improve liquidity and things like that, taking the hit up front. So that should mean they are able to bring more cash back more easily. The only downside being the value of that cash has fallen by 70% from a year ago. So it's a big struggle for them. They do obviously have a lot of other aspects to the business as well, though. With the caveat that you can't really put this whole issue aside, how does the rest of the business look in the interim results? How's it been performing?
Interestingly, it was actually quite a weak performance across the rest of the business as well in the half on a statutory basis. So revenue was down across all geographies. One highlight was market share gains for the UK personal care business for the first time in several years. But a weaker beauty brand performance still dragged revenues down in Europe and the Americas. As well as Nigeria, Asia Pacific was also hit by foreign exchange headwinds. Combining that with weak baby product sales in Indonesia meant that revenue also fell pretty heavily there. There was revenue growth on a like-for-like business, but that relied on price increases as volumes fell 5% overall. And while the operating margin rose by 110 basis points, that was on an adjusted basis. So I would say a pretty weak set of results.
This dynamic we spoke a little bit about last week, but for food producers, consumer staples, of trying to offset volume decreases with price increases, seems the pricing power isn't quite there, and or prices have been going up for so long now that volumes are really starting to take a hit, as we've seen with other companies too. So that's also a concern. The valuation in the context of all this, I mean, it was down 20% on the dividend news. How do we see it in the context of all this uncertainty at the moment?
So we're still a hold on the business. The valuation is fairly attractive. So the shares are trading at 12 times forward consensus earnings, which compares pretty favorably to other consumer stocks like Unilever, which is on 17 times. But there is a lot of uncertainty for investors, obviously, given the situation in Nigeria. And we think it could take quite a while for the share price to look a bit better. And but saying that, there is a lot of sort of brand power and brand equity at the business. It's got a pretty impressive roster of products. So there's still lots to feel positive about, I think, over the long term, but at least in the short to medium term, lots of headwinds to contend with.
Yeah, a difficult one at the moment. We'll turn to another of your companies now, reporting this morning, British American Tobacco. Let's start with the figures themselves before we get into the detail of the structural death of tobacco or otherwise, because there was a bit of news flow this morning as well. But how did the figures themselves look?
So it's a very mixed set of results from BATS, starting with the key figures. So revenue was down 1% over the last year, and that was driven by the sale of the Russian and Belarusian businesses last year. But there's also an 8% fall in cigarette volumes. As you know, the secular trend of declining smoking rates continues. Interestingly, in the key US market, cigarette volumes were down by a pretty eye-watering 11%, which is not good. On the plus side...
Not good for them, certainly.
Not good for them, yeah. On the plus side for the business, it posted revenue growth of 16% at its new categories division. So that contains vaping products, heated tobacco products, and oral products. And that division actually became profitable 2 years ahead of management's target. Volumes were up 7% for vaping products and by a third for oral pouches. But the company sold fewer heated sticks and fewer oral sticks. And management is still working towards a target of deriving half of all revenues from these products by 2035.
We'll come to vaping in a minute, but the key thing this morning, which means the shares are up a fair amount, last I looked, seems to be the indication that they are trying to sell a stake in the Indian business ITC. The reason for the enthusiasm about that is that that should bring them closer to a time when they can bring back the share buyback, because ultimately... like Imperial Brands, you know, it is being run very much on a total return basis. You know, the big dividend yield and the share buyback, when it comes, when it starts, could well be considerable. So that seems to have at least attracted some interest this morning.
Yeah, so last I looked, the shares were up 7% on the back of this news. For context, BATS has about a £15 billion stake in an Indian conglomerate called ITC. And management suggested in the results this morning that it's looking to cut this holding and bring cash into the business. And we think this could quicken the return of share buybacks because of the impact of this on getting leverage down. Buybacks were paused because of a focus on getting leverage down to the middle of the company's target range. This could be good news for investors.
The vaping side of things there, the new products, as you say, they've reached that profitability ahead of time, but... You know, when you see all the news flow around vapes and non-tobacco alternatives, as they're euphemistically called sometimes, you know, that's pretty negative, not least in the UK as well. You know, disposable vape ban, that maybe isn't such a big deal for British American Tobacco, but there's no doubt that regulators are cracking down on these products as well. How do they navigate that?
Yeah, I think something like the government's disposable vape ban could actually be good news for London-listed tobacco companies, which might sound surprising for investors who might not know a lot about the actual products they're selling. Because these companies' market share is actually being hit by lots of dodgy, illegal products coming into the US and other markets from China. So cracking down in that sense could actually be good news for BATS. In terms of the performance of new categories, so US volumes were down last year with the tougher regulatory environment having an impact. There are rumours coming out that BATS is going to try and launch its first heated tobacco product in the US soon. It's tried to do that in the past, but has come up against regulatory headwinds, so it doesn't actually have any heated tobacco products in the US at the moment. New categories volumes did a lot better in its other markets in last year, sort of in Europe and in Asia and so on.
The impairment charge was the big thing when it was pre-announced a couple of months ago. And in these results, it's even larger than the first thought. I think $27 billion rather than $25 billion on US brands. I mean, that clearly is a big figure. But given the way the world is going, is there the potential for more such things in future with, you know, some of its bigger brands and, you know, the goodwill there, which is no longer such goodwill, really?
Yeah, I think there is. So the company posted a higher than expected, yet £27.3 billion impairment charge on its acquired US tobacco assets. It flagged this in December last year when it said it expected to post a £25 billion charge against those assets because of headwinds hitting the US cigarette market. Yeah, I think the higher charge does highlight the increasingly uncertain future for cigarette performance across key markets. You have ongoing regulatory headwinds, fewer people smoking in key markets, and also the pivot towards non-tobacco products as well. And obviously the big impairment charge drove a very significant loss in the results. It's worth mentioning the pre-tax profit position was a negative $17 billion last year because of the charge.
Funny old world when that kind of thing can lead to a big share price spike, but that's why we have trading updates before the full results and, yeah. and what have you. Mark, I don't know if you have a view on BAT, because as I say, it is very much being not quite run on a runoff basis, because they do have some hopes for the new non-tobacco products, but very much the argument is the dividend yield, the share buyback is the argument there for those who want to buy this kind of company.
Yeah, definitely, because if they manage to reinstate that and keep it going for any length of time, it's conceivable that you could actually get a free carry on the stock if you held it for about 8 years, you know, given the effect of compound interest rates and reinvestments. It's odd, really, because it wasn't all that long ago that these sort of new category products were being touted as the opposite of a gateway drug, really, the type of thing that would get you off conventional tobacco products. And in fact, I don't know if it ever came to it, but there's talk of it being actually available through the NHS as well. And in that period, you know, the prospects were looking that much brighter for BATs and Imperial brands, and the other players in the market. But, you know, we seem to be stuck in this new puritanical age. So I think for shareholders, the one thing that they have to keep on top of or keep aware of is the level of cash flow into the company. The write-downs obviously aren't helping the investment case, but people are buying into it not based on a standard valuation, but just on the hope that the company manages to grow or maintain those total returns over a long enough period, so they get their original capital back, and then anything after that is cream, really.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis. We'll stay with you, Mark, because we're going to turn now to Virgin Money, which had a trading update this week, so not a full set of figures, but perhaps said some interesting things both about the business and the way it's treating or viewing the UK economy, and therefore about the UK economy itself. You looked at this in your column this week. Why don't we start by looking at the provisions that it's been taking and how they've been faring?
Yeah, well, at the time of its full-year figures, I think that was released back in November, they set aside another $307 million, I think it was, linked to expected loan delinquency. This is basically unsecured lending, credit cards and the like. That figure increased slightly in the update, but only marginally, about 7%. It was well received by the market. And when I was looking at it, it seemed to me, and in fact, it links in with what Mitch was talking about early on, the delayed impact of interest rate rises and falls in the economy. And the housing market provides an example of this, but actually the credit market that Virgin Money is operating also holds true as well. Because I was interested, I looked at some figures from the Resolution Foundation, and I was only vaguely aware of this, and I certainly wasn't aware of the scale, but they referred to the situation with net interests in UK households as being totally against the grain. In fact, they said it was unprecedented, insofar as that with increased saving rates that we've all received over the last 12 months or however long that you know, the rising part of the interest rate cycle has been going, they've more than outweighed any increases in mortgage, increased mortgage payments. The reason behind this is there's a lagged effect. A lot of people had long-standing fixed rate arrangements, and I think it was only at the beginning of this year that a lot of people have gone on to variable rates. So we can expect that benefit to decrease over time, and also given the fact that interest rates are likely to come down too. So I, looking at it again, it may be a case that looking where Virgin is at the moment, they're in a pretty decent position. They've increased their overall credit loss provision up to £578 million. And as I say, that was well accepted by the market. But there's a possibility that delinquencies might increase in the first half of this year. We also had figures out from Begbie's Traynor, their red flag alert, which suggested that there's been about a 23% increase in the number of companies that are now in severe financial distress. Now, there's obviously a difference between corporate debt and an unsecured personal debt, but it does underline that it can take a while before these interest rate increases has a material effect on businesses and households. So in summation, I would say that this is a good update from Virgin Money. It was pretty well received by the market as well, but they mightn't be out of the woods yet.
Yeah, I think they also kept their net interest margin forecast for the year stable, which is reassuring for a bank at a time when base rates are expected to fall. But yes, there is that resiliency in the provisioning. They said that, you know, certainly the delinquencies were coming in consistently better than they expected, i.e. fewer people being late on their payments. So, you know, there's a chance. Equally, you could say that they may need to take some of those provisions back. But I think you're right, they're not going to be doing that anytime soon because of this lagged effect and the risk that these things could get worse before they get better.
Plus, they've got decent liquidity coverage too, which is a point to take on board. It was very interesting, though, because it just had, you know, when I was looking at the results, or the update rather, it did have a sort of a wider spread across the economy, I think.
Mm. Julian, what are your thoughts on Virgin Money?
Yeah, it's an interesting outlier, I think, Virgin, because their main problem, I guess, is the lack of scale in comparison with the other high street brands. Mm-hmm. The reason why interest rates tend to lag with them is because the loan book isn't really big enough to absorb the shock at one time or push through the benefits at another. So they're always a quarter behind everyone else. But as Mark was saying, the fact that they are stabilizing their delinquencies is quite positive. As we go through a period where more people are actually switching to a variable rate in various products, and that means that the underlying margin, which is actually quite low for a high street bank of about 1.89% or 1.9% of net interest margin, will strengthen. So it's one of those companies where there are just lots of paradoxes at work at the same time, and the underlying figures are definitely more positive than you would expect from this point of the cycle.
Yeah, it's probably worth stating as well that one of the strongest aspects in this trading update was card lending balances growing 4% quarter on quarter, and obviously they're lending prudently or according to their risk ratios, but equally that increase in card lending is perhaps a sign of things to come as well. We've discussed in recent weeks the likes of Currys, and a lot of their credit financing scheme has seemed to take off as well in recent months, so definitely something to keep a close eye on. That, though, does bring us to the end of today's show. We have unfortunately run out of time, so thank you very much to Julian, to Mark, to Chris, to Mitch, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. We'll see you next time on another Companies and Markets show.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.